Good day. This is Susan from the Talking Information Center's Business Week Hour. So, selection of articles from the Bloomberg Business Week, starting with a long one from the January Bloomberg Business Week, Soaking Up the AI Hype. Larry Ellison has Oracle right at the center of another epic tech boom. But if the bubble bursts, he and his investors could take a serious bath, by Brody Ford and Drake Bennett. The biggest cloud computing deal in history had the humblest of origins, an unsolicited direct message over LinkedIn. It was sent in spring 2024 from an executive of OpenAI to the sales leader at Oracle Corp. Like most LinkedIn inquiries, it was a bit of a flyer. OpenAI was scrambling for computing power, as it has been, more or less constantly, since its artificial intelligence tool, ChatGPT, burst onto the scene in 2022. It had been busy signing the huge deals to rent data center space, buying the specialized AI processors, known as graphics processing units, or GPUs, and trying to develop its own chips. Nothing could satisfy its insatiable hunger for processing power. OpenAI, in short, was desperate. Happily for OpenAI, Oracle had already been sketching plans for a massive data center in West Texas. The original vision had been to partner with Elon Musk's xAI. The buildings would even be X-shaped to match the company name, say people familiar with the negotiations, who asked to remain anonymous discussing them because they were private. Musk is close with Larry Ellison, Oracle's co-founder and chairman, who was on Tesla Inc.'s board for years and has hosted Musk on Lanai, the island in Hawaii he largely owns. Despite that bond, the mercurial Musk decided he could build something faster on his own and walked away from the project. It was right around then that the fateful LinkedIn message came in. The message from OpenAI's infrastructure chief, Peter Hoschel, got the two companies talking, according to public comments Hoschel made in October. Months later, on Donald Trump's second day back in office, leaders of Oracle, OpenAI, and the Japanese investment company SoftBank Group joined the president at the White House. Together, they unveiled a plan to build AI data centers across the country. The project, which OpenAI Chief Executive Officer Sam Altman and Trump claimed would create hundreds of thousands of jobs, it was grandly named Stargate. "So put that name down in your books," Trump said, "because I think you're going to hear a lot about it in the future." Then Trump invited Ellison, who's a friend, to the presidential lectern. "Thank you, Mr. President. We certainly couldn't do this without you," Ellison said. "AI holds incredible promise for all of us, for every American." Ellison was uncharacteristically brief, but he described the project in terms that would appeal to the freshly reinaugurated real estate developer standing next to him. "The data centers are actually under construction," he said. "Each building's 500,000 square feet." There are signs the 81-year-old Ellison, long known for yacht racing, flying his own jets, and other play-hard billionaire hobbies, has finally begun to settle into a more domestic existence. He spends much of his time with his sixth wife, Jolyn, and their young children. Ellison also has two adult children, David, the chairman and CEO of Paramount Global, and Megan, a prominent film producer. He's still looking to add new chapters to his professional life, too. Oracle plans to take a stake in TikTok as part of Trump's deal to keep the social media company running in the U.S., provided the governments of the U.S. and China can agree on the details. David Ellison was shooting to become the world's most powerful media mogul by having Paramount, the parent company of CBS and MTV, buy Warner Brothers Discovery, Inc., when Warner Brothers instead reached a deal with Netflix, Incorporated. Paramount initiated a hostile takeover bid. Like many of the family's recent moves, Ellison's close ties to the president are likely to be relevant, given that either Netflix or Paramount will need regulatory approval to complete the deal. Behind the pump, Stargate is simply a very big cloud computing contract. Oracle would agree to build multiple data centers full of GPUs to train and run OpenAI's AI tools. But the deal was also far larger than what Ellison and Musk had been discussing only a few months before. OpenAI has committed to spending about $300 billion to rent servers from Oracle. The two companies have discussed further expansion of this deal, say people familiar with this matter. To provide this processing power, Oracle will have to build about 5 data center complexes, each of which will be among the largest in the world. All told, they'll require millions of chips and consume 4.5 gigawatts of power, more than all the homes in Chicago. Oracle is also helping develop data center capacity for OpenAI in the United Arab Emirates. Despite its limited experience building physical infrastructure, Oracle is aiming to get the sites online years ahead of a typical industry schedule. Some of these plans are already missing their targets. According to some people close to the work, the initial 2027 completion date for some of the U.S. data centers has slipped to 2028, largely because of labor and material shortages. An Oracle spokesperson said in a statement that the company remained confident in its ability to meet its obligations and future expansion plans. There have been no delays to any sites required to meet our contractual commitments, and all milestones remain on track, the spokesperson said, also noting that site selection and delivery timelines were established in close coordination with OpenAI. OpenAI declined to comment. This enormous undertaking is all on behalf of a startup, OpenAI, that's losing billions of dollars a year and whose software products have yet to prove they can generate anywhere near the returns necessary to justify this extraordinary investment. Before ChatGPT, such a deal might have appeared reckless. But at a time when markets had seemingly decided that there was no such thing as too much AI, Wall Street found it intoxicating. Oracle's shares shot up when the scale of the new cloud bookings became clear in early September, adding about $250 billion to its market value and making it worth more than ExxonMobil Corp. Ellison, who owns 40% of Oracle, saw his net worth climb above Musk's for a few hours at least. Ellison was, according to the Bloomberg Billionaires Index, the wealthiest person on Earth. However transformative AI ends up being for everyday life, it's already altered the tech pecking order, giving rise to newcomers such as OpenAI and turning niche players like Nvidia Corp into dominant ones. And then there's Oracle, a half-century-old database and software company that's managed to hang around for decades despite missing out on investment cycles, such as web search, mobile computing, and the cloud. It's determined not to repeat that with AI. In addition to OpenAI, Oracle has scored major deals with Meta Platforms Incorporated and NVIDIA. The company has said its infrastructure revenue will eventually surpass the rest of what it makes. In September, it reconfigured its workforce around AI, promoting its 39-year-old cloud infrastructure chief, Clay McGurk, to co-chief executive officer. So far, the economic impact of AI remains uncertain. Once you set aside the hundreds of billions of dollars being spent on data centers, warnings of a bubble abound. Oracle could be particularly vulnerable. No tech giant has gone in on AI quite the way it has. As a result of its recent deals, the company's free cash flow has gone negative for the first time since 1992. For Oracle to one day turn a profit on Stargate, its partner OpenAI will have to keep up the startling growth it has experienced over the past few years. Oracle's longtime nemesis, Microsoft Corporation, doing its own math, balked when OpenAI offered it a similar deal. To tell the story of Oracle's bet, Bloomberg Businessweek spoke to dozens of employees and leaders, in most cases anonymously, to allow for candid conversation about a famous famously litigious company with little demonstrable interest in talking to the press. In a sense, the debate over AI focuses on questions like those that have periodically swirled around Oracle, about overpromising and obfuscation and conflicts of interest. Ellison himself has been the personification of a certain kind of Silicon Valley audacity since he founded the company almost a decade before OpenAI's Altman was born. If Oracle's market cap has become a barometer on AI sentiment, it has more recently shown how quickly the atmosphere has changed. Oracle's share price had dropped by a third from its September peak by the time it reported quarterly earnings on the afternoon of December 10th. After that report revealed that expenses were growing far faster than analysts had expected and would keep doing so, its shares fell further. AI skeptical traders had already started buying Oracle credit default swaps, a form of insurance that pays off if a company can't fulfill its debts, perhaps best known as the instrument that, in 2007 and 2008, dissenters on Wall Street used to bet against the housing bubble. In the wake of the December 10th earnings announcement, the price of those swaps shot up. A few months ago, Oracle highlighted investors' belief in AI. Now it illustrates their fears. Ellison, Bob Miner, and Ed Oates founded Oracle in Santa Clara, California in 1977. It was a bygone era, before mobile phones or even personal computing, a quaint time when tech entrepreneurs were resigned to the constraints of normal human lifespans. Trying to find out exactly what their new company should do, the three settled on commercializing a radically new technology: searchable, general-purpose databases. Oracle's database software was written to run on room-filling mainframes or armoire-size mini-computers in corporate offices. The young company's first customer was famously the CIA. Applications and devices come and go, but once a company picks a database software, it rarely switches. Doing so is complicated and disruptive and involves the terrifying possibility of losing your data. Over time, Oracle built more applications in-house and acquired others. A client could use Oracle to track revenue, restock parts, onboard employees, manage relationships with customers, and assemble its quarterly reports. By the 1990s, Oracle software was ubiquitous in corporate America. Along the way, Ellison and his company gained a reputation for sharp elbows and ethical flexibility, especially in Oracle's go-go early years. Its promotional materials routinely touted capabilities its software did not, in fact, possess. Its first commercial product was dubbed Oracle 2, suggesting it was something other than what it actually was, a buggy first attempt at something viable. There's a quote in a 1997 biography, the cheekily titled "The Difference Between God and Larry Ellison," God doesn't think he's Larry Ellison, that had followed the Oracle co-founder around ever since. According to one of the company's earliest employees, Ellison used to say, "I cannot run this business and tell the truth to the customers. It's not possible." Salespeople at Oracle were notoriously aggressive, as were its accountants. In the early 1990s, the company got in legal and financial trouble for regularly counting sales when an initial deal was struck, not when a customer received and paid for the software. Since some deals inevitably fall through, this led to vastly overstating earnings, the Securities and Exchange Commission alleged. Oracle had to revise several quarterly earnings statements, and its stock lost 3/4 of its value. Some government accounting rules in place today stem from this episode. Incumbency has softened Oracle's culture a little. But to this day, an entry-level job there is seen as an education in the dark arts of high-pressure software sales. Oracle's corporate style also reflects Ellison's notorious personal combativeness. During the landmark federal antitrust trial of Microsoft in 2000, Oracle paid investors to go through the trash of advocacy groups to try to prove they were funded by Microsoft, even though Oracle had no formal involvement in the trial. Ellison saw Microsoft as a software industry rival and Bill Gates as a rival in a more nebulous competition of tech celebrity. When the dumpster diving came to light, Ellison defended it as a public service. In 2010, months after acquiring Sun Microsystems and its Java programming language, Oracle sued Google for using Java in its Android operating system without a license. The two fought the case for 11 years before the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Google's favor. As that battle raged, Oracle lobbied regulators and law enforcement agencies around the world to pursue antitrust suits against Google, something many of them went on to do. Ellison is far and away the most competitive person I've ever met, says Craig Conway, a former Oracle executive who reported to him in the 1990s. Conway found himself in his old boss's crosshairs in the early 2000s as CEO of PeopleSoft, an application company that was the target of a protracted, bitter, and ultimately successful hostile takeover by Oracle. Ellison has also shown a willingness to mix his personal interests with those of his company. The health resorts he owns on Lanai are top-of-the-line Oracle business software more associated with large enterprises. Oracle sponsors his yacht sailing league to the tune of $10 million a year. The company pays him to use his private jet for business and employs his half-brother. In 2016, Oracle agreed to spend $9.3 billion to acquire NetSuite, a software company Ellison owned almost half of. Shareholders dragged Oracle to court, alleging it had overpaid to enrich him. Oracle argued that Ellison had recused himself from the deal, even though the discussions began during a board meeting at one of his properties near Palm Springs, California. The judge ruled in Oracle's favor. Oracle was successful enough to support Ellison's quirks, feuds, and self-dealing, but it began to suffer from his failure to grasp the importance of cloud computing. Starting in the 2000s, companies such as Salesforce, Inc., founded by former Ellison protege Mark Benioff, began renting access to their software over the Internet rather than selling it to corporate customers to install on their devices. Later, Amazon Web Services, Inc. and Microsoft Azure started doing the same thing with the hardware itself, selling remote access to online servers. Such cloud-based businesses became a threat to Oracle. Publicly, Ellison wrote off the cloud as so much hype, complete gibberish, he called it back in 2008. But Oracle's customers didn't think the cloud was gibberish. They started spending more of their money with the company's new competitors. In a concession to reality, Oracle launched a cloud infrastructure business in 2012 and relaunched it in 2016, but was unable to make inroads into the market. Oracle's leadership remained skeptical. Safra Catz, co-CEO until 2019 and then CEO until 2025, was long seen as one of the corporate America's most prudent financial leaders. She was reluctant to chase the lower margins of the cloud and get into the costly business of running data centers, according to multiple employees present at the time. Instead, she sought to milk Oracle's existing database and application businesses. Even so, even today, Oracle takes in just 3% of the revenue of the cloud infrastructure market, according to Synergy Research Group. Oracle finally began bringing in big cloud contracts during the COVID-19 pandemic, when other providers couldn't keep up with the explosion of work-from-home fueled demand. One particularly notable contract was with Zoom Communications Incorporated. Oracle's most important deal, though, was with TikTok, which is owned by Chinese tech giant ByteDance Limited. Oracle had never handled a cloud account anywhere near as big as TikTok's, but the controversy around the app provided an opening. TikTok's popularity had hawkish American politicians, including Trump, raising alarms that the service could allow ByteDance, and perhaps the Chinese government, to mine the personal data of millions of Americans. Oracle seemed a perfect solution to those concerns. It had a long history as a U.S. government contractor, as well as expertise in securing sensitive government data. Compliance was third on its list of core values. ByteDance announced in June 2022 that it had migrated all U.S. TikTok user traffic onto Oracle servers. Oracle had recently moved its headquarters to Austin, so ByteDance gave the partnership an all-American name, Project Texas. Working with ByteDance generated more revenue than the rest of Oracle's cloud infrastructure customers combined, and gave it a crash course in managing data centers for a large and demanding customer. Oracle would not be where we are today without all of the opportunities and learnings that we've had from serving you and your customers, co-CEO McGurk told a ByteDance executive in October at Oracle's annual conference, AI World. The company's experience on Project Texas became particularly relevant when ChatGPT turned AI into Silicon Valley's overriding obsession. Oracle struck a deal with Microsoft to help power the AI-enabled version of Bing and went into business with the Canadian AI company Cohere and Musk's xAI, a different deal from the one for the X-shaped data centers that fell through. Illustrating the often circular nature of today's AI industry, Oracle also inked an agreement in which NVIDIA, for its own internal research and development, paid for access over the cloud to an Oracle data center full of NVIDIA chips. In the Stargate deal, part of what was so appealing to OpenAI was Oracle's eagerness to design custom data centers on incredibly tight deadlines. SemiAnalysis, a popular industry research firm, lists Oracle Cloud near the top of its rankings for AI infrastructure vendors, citing its cost-effectiveness, networking quality, and strong customer service. I have been blown away, not just by your willingness to co-design things and co-engineer, but how everyone across the Oracle Cloud infrastructure stack understands these things, OpenAI's infrastructure chief, Hoschul, told McGurk on stage at AI World. Hoschul's comments, meant as praise, touch on a tendency that alarms some Oracle investors. The company will do whatever it takes to get these AI infrastructure deals. The data centers it's racing to build will require tens of billions of dollars in upfront costs. Microsoft, Google, and a group of smaller AI-focused companies are also racing to expand their own networks of data centers, bidding up the prices of materials and labor. In a six-month period in 2024, Microsoft spent nearly $40 million on just the concrete for a single Wisconsin data center. Most of the sites OpenAI has hired Oracle to develop are still in the design stage, and it's grown particularly difficult to predict expenses for AI specialized sites at a time of rising construction costs, according to a report from construction consultant Turner & Townsend. Energy is also a major issue. Many utility companies, their capacity stretched thin, have long wait lists for data centers to connect to the grid. To get the lights turned on more quickly, Oracle has turned to novel and costly methods, such as running entire sites with gas generators. For one data center campus in rural Shackelford County, Texas, this will cost more than $1 billion per year. When it reported earnings in December, Oracle executives worked to reassure investors, with McGurk telling them it would carefully evaluate all future infrastructure investments and only proceed when it could ensure profitable delivery for our customers. The sums involved are exactly why Katz was leery of getting into the cloud infrastructure business, but those decisions are no longer hers to make. In 2025, with its stock at record highs, after disclosing the full OpenAI contract, Oracle accelerated plans to replace her with two CEOs. McGurk is focused on the cloud, while Mike Sicilia is in charge of sales and customer service. Although the two executives are ostensibly equals, Oracle hinted at its priorities by giving McGurk a compensation package worth $150 million more than Sicilia's. Both also effectively report to Ellison, who's the company's executive chairman, as well as its chief technology officer, and implicitly, its forever boss. Through creative financing, Oracle has kept many of its AI-related development costs off its own books. Vantage Data Centers, a real estate developer, is borrowing $38 billion for two data center campuses it will rent to Oracle. The other facilities are being developed under similar arrangements, with Oracle generally agreeing to lease sites for 15 years. Despite measures like this, the company itself is now deeply in debt. According to analyst predictions aggregated by Bloomberg, the company's big infrastructure bet is expected to pay off, but only after it absorbs about $70 billion in free cash flow losses over the rest of this decade. Stargate and similar deals are bets that unprecedented levels of demand for a new and specific style of computing will continue long into the future. They're premised on the idea that AI companies will require ever more immense data and computing resources, and that enough people will be willing to pay enough money for AI products that the industry will start making money. Should OpenAI's revenue stop doubling or tripling every year, the startup might not have either the need for so much computing power or the means to pay for it, and Oracle could end up sitting on some extraordinarily expensive and illiquid assets. The Stargate deal is structured so that OpenAI will have a chance to recommit or walk away after about 5 years. That's around a decade before many of Oracle's leases are up. Today, it's a seller's market for AI infrastructure. No one knows whether that will still be true by the time OpenAI has a chance to reconsider. Gil Luria, an analyst at D.A. Davidson & Company, sees three potential scenarios for the big OpenAI contract. Oracle reduces its forecasts next year, but is still able to salvage some of the work. OpenAI collapses and the contract goes away, or OpenAI achieves superintelligence, spends $1.4 trillion, none of us ever have to work again, and Oracle is fine. Aside from livening up a research note, the joke serves to illustrate an uncomfortable dynamic in AI. The current hype cycle is based in part on some monumental projections in which computers find cures for many forms of cancer, eradicate whole categories of human labor, and maybe even emerge as a kind of post-biological life form. But the dates at which these things are expected to be achieved are creeping further into the future, and maybe straight back into science fiction. Absent some transformational advantages, the logic of the outsized investment in AIs starts to look shaky. Even a consumer product as popular as OpenAI, with its 800 million active users, isn't going to be enough on its own to get the numbers to pencil out. Those who are pessimistic about Oracle worry the company focusing on closing deals based on these unrealistic expectations is making decisions that could come back to haunt it. Microsoft's approach provides a contrast. Oracle's old rival has been partners with OpenAI since 2016. The models powering ChatGPT were built on Microsoft's Azure cloud computing platform, but many at Microsoft had come to worry about tying up too much of its data center capacity on OpenAI and its unreasonable demands. Microsoft already had to limit the processing power it gives some of its biggest customers to meet OpenAI's needs. Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella summed up the concerns in a podcast interview in October, mentioning the OpenAI CEO by name. Sometimes Sam is saying, hey, can you build me a dedicated multi-gigawatt data center in one location for training? Nadella says. Makes sense from an OpenAI perspective. But Nadella continued, it doesn't make sense for Microsoft Azure. In 2024, Microsoft allowed OpenAI to seek other cloud vendors as long as Microsoft had the right of first refusal. In October, Microsoft gave up even that. Oracle, in defense of its strategy, has argued that building and selling AI infrastructure will also boost demand for the company's other products, such as databases, to store all the information the large language models draw from. There's this perspective that these AI companies are only coming to us because they're temporarily out of luck, McGurk said on stage in November. We do a good job that actually complements and supplements what these people are doing. Oracle executives spent much of AI World, a conference long known as Open World, and then briefly as Cloud World, arguing that AI is in fact a business that will be profitable over the long term. Industry analysts in the audience at times seemed skeptical. When Jackson Ader, an analyst at KeyBank Capital Markets, pressed the company on the high gross margins it offered in a cost breakdown for one of its large data centers, McGurk snapped at him. I feel like you're confused. If Ader is confused about what Oracle is doing, he's not the only one. The recent drop-off in its share price suggests that investors may now question Oracle's delivery timeline and profit projections for the new work. It hasn't helped that OpenAI has since made multi-billion dollar deals with Amazon.com, Advanced Micro Devices, Broadcom, and CoreWeave. OpenAI has also talked publicly about potentially building its own data centers. Now, Oracle is just one of the many companies constructing data centers for OpenAI and hoping it pays all its bills. You've seen an inverse correlation between OpenAI's commitments and Oracle's stock price, Ader says. As the amount of spend grows at OpenAI, the value of each commitment goes down. Silicon Valley culture has generally championed the young and audacious. Ellison is playing a central role in yet another tech boom in his ninth decade. Gates has long moved on to philanthropy, and Ellison's old friend Steve Jobs died years ago. The Oracle co-founder, on the other hand, actually increased the share of workers he oversees in this year's reorganization, according to documents reviewed by Business Week in November. Perhaps most crucially, he controls the company's spending. The top finance executive now reports directly to him, bypassing both CEOs. And of course, Ellison has always held sway at the company he founded and in which he's still the largest shareholder. He rarely comes to the office, but is a regular presence via video conference from his properties around the world, weighing in on decisions big and small. 48 years into Oracle's existence, he still has thoughts on which product lines the company should emphasize and about things like the placement of buttons on Oracle Health's virtual interface. And while his public appearances are less frequent, Ellison continues to be willing to muse publicly on topics far from Oracle's core business. During his AI WorldNote keynote in October, he took 10 minutes to offer his thoughts on farming. We can't keep taking habitat and converting it to farmland, he said. We need to be much more efficient. Mostly, though, his 90-minute speech focused on AI. 2 years earlier, he pointed out, at what was then Cloud World Conference, he publicly asked if AI would be the most important technology in human history. He isn't wondering anymore. It's the largest, fastest-growing business in human history, he said. Bigger than the railroads. Bigger than the Industrial Revolution. All that needs to happen for Oracle's bet to pay off is for him to be right. From the February Bloomberg Businessweek, a smear of liver, a daub of heart. When Rob McDaniel makes smoothies for his four kids, he tosses in berries, some wildflower honey, and an ounce or two of raw beef liver. They think that's what smoothies taste like, says McDaniel, a physician's assistant and the chief executive officer of Primal Pastures, which bills itself as the cleanest meat in America and sells direct to consumer chicken gizzards and beef hearts. They love them. McDaniel's business is just one of many offering organ meats to the masses, capitalizing on a cultural moment by way of some savvy branding and blending. Recasting offal, O-F-F-A-L, edible animal innards, as primal and ancestral, companies have been able to appeal to the burgeoning Make America Healthy Again crowd and its penchant for so-called natural food. The rebranding has also helped the less zealous get comfortable with a bit of kidney in their burgers, as has a modern approach that relies on mixing offal with other meats. A selling point of blends containing 80% ground beef, 10% beef liver, and 10% beef heart is that you won't even taste the organs. Force of Nature Meats, considered the trailblazer in selling packaged organ blends, it sold in more than 4,000 locations, including Publix, coined the term ancestral, which many other brands have adopted. It's a pretty welcoming and inviting name, says CEO Robbie Sansom. When Sansom first pitched organ meat blends, people looked at us like we had four eyes and a tail. Times have changed. The sales of beef offal have jumped 49% since 2020, and chicken offal has surged 388% in that time, according to consumer insights company Circana. At Sprouts Farmers Market, a natural food chain with more than 450 grocery stores, ancestral ground beef is its top-selling frozen meat item. Whole Foods Market, which stocked a single organ meat blend in 2021, now offers products from five different animals: venison, beef, bison, chicken, and turkey, chock full of heart, liver, and gizzard. Brands selling tallow, a rendered fat often made from beef, are enjoying some MAHA, Make America Healthy Again, driven success too. This is how we cook the MAHA way, declared Robert F. Kennedy Jr., then the nominee to head the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, when deep frying his 2024 Thanksgiving turkey in the rendered fat. In January, the administration unveiled a new upside-down food pyramid as part of nutrition guidelines that emphasize protein and encourage Americans to cook with beef tallow. Whole Foods has seen a 132% boom in sales of products featuring tallow, like Jesse and Ben's fries and jars of Epic Provisions beef tallow. Our customers love its ability to upgrade the culinary status of almost any dish, its high smoke point, and the richer flavor it adds compared to other oils, says Brooke Gill, a spokesperson for the grocer, which listed tallow at the top of its 2026 food trends. Organ blends and tallow go hand in hand. Primal Pastures also offers jars of beef tallow, while Epic Provisions sells beef liver bites. The popularity of these products is notable given an affordability crisis that sent the cost of even the most basic grocery staples soaring. A pound of Force of Nature's ancestral beef blend costs $13.99, compared with $9.99 for a packaged pound of grass-fed beef at Whole Foods. Offal are not actually cheap cuts of meat, says Eugene Kang, CEO of Archer Meat Snacks, which makes an organ meat stick. Both Kang and Sansom are buying parts that have traditionally gone to pet food makers. Of the Purinas of the world, Sansom explains, we've taken the cost of one of their favorite ingredients and driven it up considerably. U.S. consumption of organ meats peaked in the 1940s, thanks to wartime rationing and scarcity of muscle cuts. Companies supplying organ meat again saw a spike in demand during the COVID-19 pandemic. This time, Americans' preoccupation with their health, a renewed focus that would sow the seeds of the Maha movement, pushed culinary exploration of the less popular parts of the animal. It was also helped along by the rise of a colorful figure known as the Liver King. A muscle-strapped influencer from Texas, Brian Johnson, not that other health-obsessed Brian Johnson, started amassing millions of followers online in 2021 by extolling the virtues of his ancestral diet, heavy on raw organ meat, claiming it helped solve his son's health problems and build his own glistening muscles. The Liver King was both a blessing and a curse, says Ken Power, co-founder of True Beef Organic, which sells organic meat online. Johnson helped foment a frenzy that led to fitness-crazed young men buying so much organ meat that Power placed a 30-pound limit on liver and a 20-pound limit on kidneys and hearts. When he called customers trying to game the system by using their mother's credit cards, he learned some were eating 2 to 3 pounds of organ meat daily and urged them to scale back, both for their health and so others could buy some. Demand at True Beef has since evened out, and Power says a wider profile of customers is now coming to us. Organ meat is a concentrated way to get nutrients like protein, B vitamins, magnesium, selenium, and zinc, says Julia Zampano, a registered dietitian at the Cleveland Clinic. However, she notes, organ meats can lead to higher levels of saturated fat and cholesterol if consumed in excess, and they should always be cooked to avoid bacterial contamination. Unsurprisingly, raw liver wasn't in fact the source of the Liver King's physique. In late 2022, it was revealed his muscles were aided by steroids. But not to worry, there's another multi-million follower influencer taking on the organ meat crusade. Paul Saladino is a proponent of the carnivore diet, downing shots of raw milk with Kennedy during a taping of the Paul Saladino MD podcast at the White House in May. He co-founded Lineage Provisions in 2023, which sells what else? Air-dried organ meat sticks and grass-fed beef tallow. My fridge is heart, liver, meat, butter, and fruit, Saladino proclaimed on his show. It's just super simple. And maybe some brains or some testicles. From the March Bloomberg Businessweek, giving up on home ownership can hurt you in the long run, by Young-Gyun Yoo and Sung Ha-Young Lee. Home ownership in the United States offers stability and a path to building credit and equity. That's why it's still a central part of the American dream. But as U.S. home prices outpace wages, that dream has become increasingly unattainable. In a 2022 survey of millennials, rental marketplace Apartment List found the share of respondents who expected to rent forever had nearly doubled to almost 25%, from 13% in 2018. A Harris poll from 2024 found that 42% of all U.S. adults and almost half of Generation Z agreed with the statement, "No matter how hard I work, I will never be able to afford a home I really love." As economists, we wanted to know how fading hopes of home ownership stand to shape the lives of younger generations in the decades to come. Buying a home is one of the biggest investments most people ever make, requiring them to sock away money for years before expending a large portion of their savings. We found that as individuals perceived likelihood of homeownership diminishes, they systematically shift their behavior. They consume more relative to their wealth, stop working as hard, and choose riskier investments such as cryptocurrencies. We found this by building a mathematical model to simulate households' financial trajectories from age 20 to 75. The model, which we calibrated using real-world data from the Federal Reserve's Survey of Consumer Finance, the U.S. Census, and other sources, incorporates many of the parameters that affect personal financial decisions, such as fluctuating wages and housing prices, as well as baseline wealth, mortgage debt, risk of default, and desire to pass assets on to children. We ran the model to reveal how differences between types of households across different generations make different choices over their lifetimes. We found that roughly 84% of people born in 1950 will purchase a home at some point during their working life, in line with real-world census data showing that 82% of U.S. residents born in 1950 currently own homes. But only 74% of those born in 1990 will reach that milestone according to our model. The model also shows how giving up on home ownership shifts long-term financial trajectories. We compared two renters who entered early adulthood with similar levels of wealth, but different outlooks on home ownership. A 20-year-old renter on a likely path to buying a home saves more and works harder to accumulate wealth over time. They eventually sign a deed and continue to build wealth through savings and home equity well into their later years. But another 20-year-old renter with a lower probability of homeownership winds up on a radically different path. The discouraged renter accumulates virtually no assets over decades, living largely hand-to-mouth. The divergence emerges early on when a household decides whether to save for a house, and that single fork in the road can lead to enormous gaps in lifetime wealth. Foregoing ownership may be a rational response to housing becoming unaffordable. Imagine saving diligently for years only to watch already high housing prices sprint even further out of reach. Without a credible future target to discipline their choices, people start to spend their money on other things, such as luxury goods, crypto investments, or other unreliable stores of value. We observe this by comparing renters and homeowners with similar levels of net worth captured in nationally representative data from consumer research firm MRI Simmons. Among richer Americans, homeowners and renters invest in crypto at roughly equal rates. Among renters with a net worth below $300,000, crypto participation is much more common than among homeowners with a lower net worth. Perhaps these renters are hoping to gamble their way back into the housing market. We see similar trends among quiet quitters at work. Among homeowners, it's just 2 to 3% who report a lower work ethic across all net worth levels. The same holds for renters with high net worth. But among renters with a net worth below $300,000, the share reporting a lower work effort jumps to 4 to 6%. This deprioritizing of work can be seen in news reports about young people setting boundaries with employers and valuing well-being over achievement. While pundits often dismiss these patterns as signs of laziness, at least part of the story may be more structural. When the incentive to strive fades, behaviors change. The downside of declining affordability isn't simply that fewer Americans will own homes. It could become a broader problem for society. Our model shows that a significant share of those who give up on home ownership end up working fewer hours and contributing less in income taxes, shifting the fiscal burden onto others and reducing the economy's overall productive capacity. To tackle the affordability crisis, the Trump administration has called for a $200 billion mortgage bond stimulus in a bid to drive down lending rates. Both Republicans and Democrats have sought to ease regulatory barriers holding back the housing supply. We haven't studied those policies, but our research shows that simply giving a simple cash subsidy to prospective homeowners can be far more effective if it spurs persistent behavior change. For example, by targeting households on the verge of giving up so they remain hopeful instead. If policymakers act too late, after young people have progressed too far down the path of futility, it may be impossible to put them back on track. From the January Bloomberg Business Week, Buy Your Luxury Secondhand by Amanda Mull. Even in the best of times, luxury fashion is a tricky business. The contraindication at the heart of the largely European industry, its goods command high prices because they're putatively rare or special. But they're produced at industrial scale and sold in every corner of the globe, is always threatening to collapse in on itself. That's true even if two decades of boom times have made the whole proposition seem far less precarious than perhaps it should. Now that precarity is on full display. As recently as 2023, it was easy to feel as if the good times would last forever. That year, LVMH, Moët, Hennessy, Louis Vuitton SE, fashion's largest and most powerful conglomerate, which owns brands including Louis Vuitton and Dior, brought in more than $100 billion in revenue, the company's largest haul, and a more than 50% increase from only 4 years earlier. The industry had been on the receiving end of a cash cannon fired by affluent people all over the world, whose savings accounts had grown fat during the pandemic from vacations not taken and tasting menus not eaten, to say nothing of their ballooning brokerage accounts, cryptocurrency wallets, and property values. Those shoppers, bored at home, evinced a willingness to buy almost anything Europe's fashion giants had on offer, and at seemingly any price. Luxury brands responded to that willingness, or if you want the company's line, to rising costs of labor and raw materials, by jacking up their prices further and faster than most of their customers could have imagined possible. A report from HSBC Holdings PLC found that the prices of luxury goods in Europe increased an average of 54% from the end of 2019 through September 2024, far outpacing inflation. Some of the most sought-after items soared even higher. In 2019, a medium-sized Chanel classic flap bag, one of the most popular and recognizable designs in fashion history, cost $5,800 in the United States. At the beginning of 2025, that same bag would have set you back $10,200. By then, the cracks in global fashion's facade had become visible. Luxury is in a death spiral, the longtime fashion editor and lecturer Catherine Zarella wrote in a New York Times op-ed at the height of the 2024 holiday shopping season. That year, both LVMH and Kering SA, fashion's other heavyweight conglomerate, which owns Gucci and Balenciaga, among others, would post revenue declines. And both are on track for further declines once 2025 is tallied. Growth stalled for a whole host of reasons. Prices are ridiculous, yes, but also the industry's ideas were stale. The quality of many of its products had declined enough for customers to notice, and the Chinese economy faltered, stifling the spending power of the consumers who'd for years been European fashion's most reliable driver of expansion. Then the election of Donald Trump brought with it tariff chaos, recession fears, and a stagnant U.S. job market, spooking the middle-income American shoppers whom luxury marketers had worked for decades to persuade to splurge on $600 logo belts and $3,000 handbags every now and then. Fashion's issues were bad enough this year that the state of the industry became fodder for discussion among the young people whose patronage will be crucial to its future. On TikTok, videos from Chinese manufacturers went viral in the U.S., claiming to expose the dubious origins of European luxury products. And in China, disenchantment with Europe's fashion giants has provided an opening for homegrown luxury brands to expand, some of them as much as 1,000%. Industry executives have undertaken a number of efforts to staunch the bleeding, most notably by bringing in fresh creative talent to breathe life into some of the most important brands in the business. Balenciaga, Bottega Veneta, Celine, Chanel, Dior, Fendi, Gucci, Loewe, and Valentino, among a slew of others, all have new designers at the helm, a level of simultaneous upheaval unprecedented in the industry's modern era. Fashion brands aren't just working against their own price hikes and creative stagnancy to lure back customers. They're also working against the sometimes superior design and materials they offered to customers in years past. Huge selections of those goods, not to mention plenty of lightly used examples of current designs, are widely available for pennies on the dollar on resale platforms such as RealReal Incorporated and Vestiaire Collective. Shoppers might be balking at what's available in luxury boutiques, but at least some of those dollars are now flowing into the secondhand fashion market, which is growing at 3 times the rate of the market for new goods. The same report from Boston Consulting Group valued the current global secondhand market at $210 billion with a projected value of $360 billion by 2030. The powerhouses of traditional luxury have long sought to distance themselves from the secondhand trade, and most refuse to verify the authenticity of products purchased at resale. With every passing year, though, their customer base becomes more open to the prospect of shopping from other people's closets, and the conglomerate's pricing games and middling output will continue to push holdouts to reconsider. There's never been a better time to shop for a gently used leather bag or cashmere sweater, and secondhand shopping offers an opportunity that the biggest brands haven't been able to credibly present to shoppers in years. The prospect of finding something truly special and unexpected and escaping the hunt with your finances intact. This has been Susan from the Talking Information Center and the Bloomberg Businessweek Hour. I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.